Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, we'll be talking about some things with some people. Well, yeah. Daniel McAdams will be on the show from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And so that'll be cool. Haven't spoken with Dan in a little while. And plus, I got a ton of news to cover. And, I don't know. I have a bad radar lately for picking guests. Keep picking guests who just can't seem to do it today. That's all right. I like talking about this stuff. I'll interview myself. Like, for example, oh man, this is going to make you all turn off this show. I should do a poll. Can you guys stand it when I cover Rand Paul's presidential campaign? I won't go by what you decide. I just am interested to know, I guess. I can't help it, man. I wish I could just tune him out. I know wise people who say, I have no time in my life for that. Don't pay any attention to it. Ain't going to discuss it or argue about it. Don't care. Ain't watching. Now, that's a good way about looking about things, man, but I can't do it. No. Got to talk about Rand Paul. Because, see, the problem is, of course, he's Ron Paul's son. So that means he has access to a great example to follow. Let's put it that way. And he keeps screwing it up. And it drives me crazy. But then, sometimes he does things right a little bit. So then that just makes the whole campaign, the whole idea of Rand Paul that much more frustrating. I'm like, yeah, see? When you tell the truth and you do it right, you win. You do well. So quit pandering and just go out there and pretend you're your dad for a little while. He's the one who's good on everything anyway. You know what I mean? Like, say for example, instead of saying, hey, me and my dad, we're different guys. Stop coming at me with everything he ever said. What if he said, bring it on. I welcome the exercise. Pitch me softballs all day long. Accuse me of what my dad said. And I'll explain why he's right about everything. That would be so easy. And also, well, it seems like it would probably have a pretty good chance, at least, of inspiring people the way his father's campaigns inspired people to change their lives, basically change who they were and what they believed. He led them. And, Rand, boy, you know, he's just always getting out ahead of himself, calculating things like, well, I should be really bad on Iran, and then I can be a little bit better on Syria, or whatever, however he does the so-called calculus. Hate that term. Anyway, so what happened was, I think he got caught unawares. I don't know, I don't think he, you know, had a practiced talking point. He got caught out on the Megyn Kelly show. She said, Charles Krauthammer says, you're just like Obama. And his answer to that was actually, Charles Krauthammer's the one who's exactly like Obama. Look at the violent things that Obama's done that I warned against. Like, for example, the wars in Libya and Syria that I said will only multiply our enemies, which is exactly what they've done. I think he realized then, it was sort of unescapable, that, wow, caught without a pandering talking point, he told the truth, and it did really well. If Krauthammer, I always said it wrong. If Krauthammer was sitting right there, then he wouldn't have had a thing to say. I mean, Rand completely solidly whooped him. It didn't matter that it was Megyn Kelly standing in for him. And I think he learned a lesson from that, because then he went on a Sunday morning news show, and he said pretty much the same thing. I think it got under Rand's thin skin a little bit, that the war party started running ads against him on the day of his announcement of his campaign. They rained all over his parade by running TV ads, the neocons did, saying that, you know, the emergency committee for Israel, I believe it was, or those closely associated, saying, oh, Iran just wants to surrender before the Iranians like Obama or this kind of thing. And so now they got them fighting mad. So my thing is, I wonder if it's possible for him to understand that no matter how much he panders, no matter how much he tries to appease the war party, to put it in their terms, the more he undermines his own base, and then he still ends up accomplishing nothing with them, and that they still hate him anyway, and that it's all wasted. And he doesn't just have to be good on Libya and Syria. He could be on he could be good on Afghanistan, and good on Yemen, and good on Iraq. I mean, the stay out of Iraq line is an easy one. Listen, if we fight against the Islamic State, we're fighting for the Bada Brigade and the Peshmerga in a way that's just going to lead to worse consequences down the line. And if we fight against them, then we're fighting for the Islamic State. We sure as hell don't want that. In Syria, it's either Assad or the jihadists. How about neither? How could anyone support intervening on the side of the rebellion against the secularist dictatorship there that all the minorities are hiding behind? It's madness. Like de-Bothifying the army in Iraq, which we already learned that lesson. Abolishing the secular Ba'athist state, abolishing their army, and what comes after that? Bunch of sectarian cleansing and civil war, and worse, if you think the war so far has been bad. But then, look at how bad the war so far has been. The Assad government has killed a hell of a lot of people, and innocent ones as well. And it makes no sense whatsoever to back him and his regime for moral reasons and for the same consequences of playing right into the Islamic State's hands, really, by proving their story right, that the Americans back the Shiite axis against them. And so just quit. All this intervention from George H.W. Bush through Bill Clinton through W. and through Obama has just led to worse and worse crisis all along. So just quit. What's so hard about that? I want to hear Rand Paul answer an honest question about Afghanistan. Well, so they tried to leave Afghanistan, and yet the Taliban's still there and still fighting, and they can't seem to leave because they're afraid of a fall of Saigon type thing for political reasons. Are you willing to have a fall of Saigon moment on your during your presidency, or are you going to keep troops there for 4 or even 8 years just so that you're not the president in charge to lose the Afghan war that can't be won, that's already lost several times over, in fact? Is he got to think of the political thing to say there, or just tell the people the truth? The American people don't want to own Afghanistan. It would be sad for innocent people dying there when all the artificial power we've propped up falls down and innocent people are killed in the backlash and all of that. But whose fault is that? America's politicians, as much as the Taliban, who will be coming back to power to great degrees anyway. Why give them a political answer? Why not just tell them the truth and lead? You know, I mean, the way it works in politics anyway, as you can tell, is there are only the first and second tier candidates. And people like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, they got a real steep hill to climb, where Jeb Bush is already sitting on top. Not because the people like Jeb Bush. This isn't a democracy. This ain't sixth grade. Jeb Bush has the establishment locked up. So how could someone in the second tier possibly dislodge somebody like Jeb Bush? They would need a mass movement behind them, a mass movement of people led, maybe by someone telling them something true and important about, for example, maybe the empire and the future of it.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. That's why I named that, because that's my name. All right, so in the Daily Beast, Shane Harris, who I guess is the editor there now. No, Shockman's the editor. I forgot what this guy Shane Harris is. Anyway. Obama's lawyers, let's extend the 9/11 wars forever. And this is about, for example, Afghanistan. When Obama says in a speech, yeah, the war is over. Combat operations have ended and this, that, and you can forget it. Oh, yeah, no, that's not a legal thing. He didn't mean that, said the lawyer for the Pentagon in his speech. No, what he meant was we're still at war in Afghanistan and we'll be there forever. At least until the end of Hillary Clinton's second term after two Jeb Bush terms. Boy, what a horrifying future we have ahead of us. Anyway. There you go. Afghanistan, Taliban, and Al-Qaeda are still there, Preston said. And so this goes with the story from yesterday or the day before about how, yeah, actually they're not going to pass a new authorization to use military force, which probably, all things considered, is a good thing. But it just means that they're going to go on, like it says here in this headline, using the AUMF from 2001. And they're just going to pretend it says "and all associated groups" in there. And then they're just going to pretend that whoever they say is an associated group. And they're just going to take their check, their blank check, and keep running with it. And so I don't know. It's I guess, trivial, actually, in the scheme of things, right? The unconstitutional nature of all of this. But why should any of this lawlessness be lawful or be based on anything that's supposed to be by the rules, the original rules? That would just, sanctify it in a way, supposedly, in a way that it doesn't deserve to be, seems like. Anyway. Now, the claim is, in The Guardian this morning, that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the self-declared Caliph Ibrahim of the Islamic State, was, in fact, wounded in that attack back in March. Was it March or was it earlier where they claimed that they thought that they had got him and all that? I think it might have been earlier. This may have been a different attack. But anyway, I don't know. Maybe it was the same thing. Now they're saying he almost died, but he didn't. His wounds were at first life-threatening. But they say he's doing better now. Sorry for the dead air, I was sneezing. I should have a thing that plays the Beasties while I sneeze or something like that. I guess I could have a channel on this board that's just nothing but music. And be my sneeze button. Anyway. Point being, I don't know if this is propaganda or not. Maybe he'll come out on the balcony and give a proclamation sometime soon. But I don't know what difference it would make. Maybe it'd make a lot of difference. I don't know. I'm real torn on what to think about the Islamic State, you know, in and of itself, and how much power and authority it has. Coburn's impressed. So really, you can take that to the bank, right? Coburn says they are a state that's the size of Britain. They're surrounded by enemies, but all of whom hate each other, too, and refuse to work together, really do anything about them. And they've got taxation, they've got conscription, they've got civil and criminal court systems that they're building. And on the other side of that, and I admit I hadn't read them in a little while, but on the other side of that, the best example I can think of is the war nerd, Gary Brecher, or John Dolan is his actual name, I think. And he writes for Pando, and before that, The Exiled. And I really like that guy. I mean, he's a mean son of a bitch. It's not that he's an anti-interventionist, principal libertarian type, but he's just really smart, and he's incredibly interested in all the conflicts on the planet. And he's a talented writer, and so, you know, he's good to read. And his point of view is, I think, much more along the lines of, these guys really are nothing but Al-Qaeda in Iraq, only with a few more men. They're nothing but a militia of fighters. They're no caliphate. They're just, what they are is they're a militia occupying no man's land. But as far as, you know, actually having, you know, revenue and power and serving as a real threat, they don't. And their goose will be cooked soon enough, and just look at what happened with them getting run out of Kobani and all that. On the other hand, you know, I saw Mitchell Prothero on Twitter yesterday was arguing with a bunch of Iraqis about what was going on, and he insulted the efficacy of the officer corps of the Iraqi army and said when it comes to, you know, going toe-to-toe, the Islamic State has better infantry than the Iraqi army does. They're better fighters, and they're, you know, braver and whatever. That's not his word, braver, but whatever. More willing to take risks and get the job done, however it was that he phrased it. And that's really something. You know, he used to really refer to these guys as a bunch of crazy school shooters, but I think he learned real quick that, yeah, that Islamic State alliance with the old Ba'ath Party military officer corps of Saddam Hussein's government is kind of all important. You know, I am kind of suspicious now that I think about it. At first, when I read this article about Baghdadi being wounded, I thought, I don't know. For whatever reason, it feels like maybe it's true and based on good sourcing. Yeah. But then there was this story the other day about Al-Duri dying. And that one really took off, despite the fact that, as far as I know, the only source for it really was Iraqi state media. You know, Iraqi government official claims, which are about as, you know, reliable as Ukrainian government claims or American government claims. That is, not at all. Would be an important kill, I think, if they got Al-Duri, who supposedly was the most Islamist, the most bin Ladenite leaning of all of Saddam's military leadership back then. And apparently has played a pretty important role in the Islamic State. Oh, and by the way, so there's this article in The Guardian. It's called Former Saddam Hussein Spy Masterminded the Rise of ISIS, says report. Now, so this report, I'm glad they brought this up again. I didn't run it on antiwar.com because it had a bunch of crap in there about Assad basically having a tacit alliance with ISIS, which is a nice piece of propaganda, but it's not true. And so that was 86 for me. But it's still an important story, and, well, hell, I don't have time to talk to you about it. Hang on.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, anyway, sorry I didn't time that out very well, but I wanted you guys to look at this. Former Saddam Hussein spy, mastermind of the rise of ISIS, says report. And you should read the thing in Der Spiegel anyway, even though it's got some crap in it. In fact, the only thing that is wrong with it is I have no idea whether any of it is true. And the other thing that's wrong with it is they try to perpetuate this myth that the Assad government was just perfectly happy to watch the rise of the Islamic State, which was always just a cover story for America and its NATO allies and its GCC allies were helping to build up al-Nusra, which ended up and the Islamic Front and Ahrar al-Sham and whatever other Islamist, all bin Ladenite groups that were fighting against Assad. And it was their fault. What they did was what led to the rise of the Islamic State. So they blamed it on the enemy of the Islamic State, the Assad government. The whole thing is completely ridiculous. But anyway, other than that, assuming the premise is true that they really got their hands on these papers and that they are legitimate papers, which is a big assumption, but it's still entertaining read and, you know, possibly informative read. Well, they talk about basically this Ba'ath Party alliance with the Islamists and how these guys, you know, basically created, they compare it to the Stasi, the internal security forces for the members of the party that runs the caliphate. And this is how they're enforcing their state, is brutal rule within and without, and very well organized, which, you know, I don't know, supposedly is their asset, I guess could be to a degree, unless they get too organized, then they'll fall apart. But anyway, it's worth reading, and here, there's a thing about it in The Guardian here. It is, like I say, pretty big assumption that, one, the story's even really legit at all, and it's certainly a huge and, I think, pretty obviously false assumption, what they spin in there about the alliance between Assad and ISIS. They meant America. All right. Egypt's ousted President Morsi jailed for 20 years. Well, that'll probably be the rest of his life, but at least they didn't give him life. How dare he get elected to office? And, so there you go. At least they didn't execute him. You know, it's funny. In Egypt, they're always sentencing people to death, but they don't seem to carry it out that much. Not the big name recipients of the death penalty, anyway. Weren't there hundreds of Muslim Brotherhood leaders sentenced to death? Whatever happened to that? I'm not saying hurry up and kill them. I'm just saying, whatever happened to that? An Egyptian court has sentenced ousted President Mohamed Morsi to 20 years in jail for ordering the arrest and torture of protesters during his rule. It is the first verdict he has received since his overthrow as one of several trials he faces. Oh, look at the BBC here. Morsi was deposed by the military in July 2013 following mass street protests against his rule. Oh, is that how it went? You know, like, I mean, they really think that we're going to confuse that military coup d'etat with the revolution that overthrew Hosni Mubarak in 2011? Give me a break. Since then, the authorities have banned the Muslim Brotherhood movement and arrested thousands of Morsi's supporters. Morsi and 14 other Brotherhood figures escaped a more serious charge of inciting the killing of protesters, which would have carried the death sentence. Of course, in the aftermath of the coup, in the next day and 2 days, the military killed more than 1,000 people protesting the coup, supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. Imagine if that happened in a state that was backed by the Russians, like in, say, Belarus, and their government massacred 1,000 people in the streets for protesting a military overthrow of their democratically elected leader. Oh, no, but it's our guys. Our sock puppet fascist military dictatorship that overthrows a democratically elected leader and slaughters 1,000 people in the street. And then, hey, John Kerry said that's, quote, the restoration of democracy. Yeah, don't you hate it when a mass movement of virtually the entire civilian population of the nation of Egypt overthrows their military dictator, elects the conservative, and then he's overthrown within a year and a half by the next military dictator in line, Field Marshal al-Sisi, who, of course, is, that means that he's a desk ranger, brave leader of bureaucrats. Anyway, so, yeah, it's just a coincidence the military tough guy's name is Sisi, right? Not that he's compensating for anything. Anyway, so there's the BBC covering up for the lie. But so there's Morsi sentenced to 20 years. And you know what? The Muslim Brotherhood sucks. I don't even know, apologies for the Muslim Brotherhood. They're founded by fascists. Basically, they're Egyptian nationalist fascists. But the thing about them is, that's who they were back when they worked with the CIA back in the days against Nasser. And then, oops, they kind of got a little too big for their britches, call it blowback, and turned on America's next sock puppet, Anwar Sadat. But anyway, by the time all this happened, 2011, 12, 13, they're a bunch of old men, rich old men, doctors, lawyers, property owners, businessmen. In other words, not radicals, conservatives. Yeah, right wingers, but fully negotiable with. They're basically just Republicans. That's who they are. The Muslim Brotherhood are the Republican Party of Egypt, which is really bad. I'm not saying it's not really bad, but I'm just saying, you know, four fingers pointed back at you as you accuse and all that kind of thing. You know what I mean? But hey, you know, and you know what? Seriously, the Israel, you know, Morsi made no moves whatsoever to change his relationship with America or Israel in any severe way. Or Saudi Arabia, for that matter. Or I don't know, I guess he one time said he wanted to make a trip to Iran. But anyway, he never did anything to really upset the Israelis or the Americans other than just getting elected. Anyway, so I'm not saying boo-hoo, poor politician. I'm just pointing out the hypocrisy. I think all politicians should be sentenced to 20 years, frankly. Except that I don't think anyone has the authority to sentence them to 20 years. That's the only problem. But otherwise, got no love for him or his stupid party or anything, but I'd just rather tell the truth than go along with a bunch of crap. The restoration of democracy as that military dictatorship overthrows an elected government and massacres people in the streets. Hey, as long as they're on our side, right? All right. Well, and I'm out of time to cover Yemen, so we'll get back to Yemen after the break coming up here. So I'll just say, did you notice that during Bush's entire democratic crusade, as he called it, in the Middle East, it was only against countries that America didn't control anymore, like Iraq and Iran? I don't know if Syria was ever really an American sock puppet state, but they worked with us on things. But they never meant to export democracy to Egypt or Saudi, did they? You ever catch on to that? Kuwait, where our war that got us into this in the first place was to put him back on his throne?
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Now, I don't know what's in this Iranian boat. Is it still heading to Yemen? How long does it take to get from Iran to Yemen? I don't know what's on it, but I'm skeptical that there's weapons on it because all the claims are that there's weapons on it. And so, going with the tradition of assuming that they're always lying about everything, they being the American Empire and everybody who agrees with it, everybody making accusations, I'm going to assume that there's not until somebody proves that there is a bunch of weapons on board. Jason Ditz writes at news.antiwar.com, last week the Pentagon joined in the naval blockade of Yemen slightly with a U.S. ship boarding a Panamanian cargo ship they accused of having Iranian weapons on board. They didn't find any. Now the U.S. is doubling down, adding the USS Theodore Roosevelt, that's fitting, an aircraft carrier. I don't know if he means Roosevelt, an aircraft carrier, or Roosevelt, an aircraft carrier, along with several support ships, anyway, nominally to stop the weapons shipments that neither they nor any of their allies have been able to prove are happening. The naval blockade of Yemen has so far had the impact of keeping humanitarian aid ships from docking several places and has forced several food ships to park off coast for weeks on end, awaiting assorted permissions to dock. The desert-heavy nation of Yemen imports over 90% of its food, and that is almost entirely by ship. The naval blockade has slowed those shipments, and in many cases, cargo companies are refusing to even attempt to deliver, since the navies involved in the blockade seem to leave them waiting off coast forever for deliveries that weren't necessarily the highest paying to start with. So there you go. Just completely destroying Yemen, man. Think about that. They import 90% of their food. Warning Iran, U.S. sends two more ships to Yemen is the headline. Yeah, it is the aircraft carrier Roosevelt. That's the headline in the New York Times. And now, why should we believe that the Houthis need Iranian weapons? That they're even low on ammo at all? Or that the Iranians are anxious to intervene in this thing? And we know that that's a premise that a lot in the war party would like to push. That's an assertion they would like us to all accept as fact, as Charles Schumer might say. But I haven't seen a single anecdote yet. Now, I'm not certain what that boat is doing. Maybe it is bringing them weapons. Maybe it's bringing them weapons. But nobody's proved that. And there have been all kinds of boats from all different ships, from all different countries that have gone there to pick up their civilians. The only people not rescuing their civilians, their citizens stranded in Yemen, are the Americans. I don't know if that's changed, but less than a week ago, anyway, there was a report in McClatchy where they're just refusing to go and try to rescue any civilians. Hey, you know, the lives of the soldiers are of greater value than the civilians they're supposedly protecting, right? That's what it says in the Declaration of Independence. People are instituted among governments to secure the blessings of their authority. Everybody knows that. So anyway, Saudi Arabia has been in a bombing campaign against the Houthis for weeks, and the U.S. wanted to make clear to Iran that it backed the airstrikes. So, you know what? Let me look at this. Let me put this in Google News and figure out what's the latest on this. You could have a giant Gulf of Tonkin ridiculous start of a war right here over some nonsense. Let's get the latest from Google News here. U.S. warships to monitor ships traveling from Iran is the latest from an hour ago at CNN. Well, nobody started bombing each other yet, seemingly. I mean, obviously there's all kinds of people being bombed in Yemen. Like, for example, 46 civilians killed as Saudi warplanes attack Yemen capital, hundreds wounded as strikes set off flurry of explosions. It's also from yesterday at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com by Jason Ditz. Several hundred wounded, 46 killed after Saudi warplanes launched attacks on the outskirts of a missile depot in the Yemeni capital city of Sana'a. No military casualties were reported in the strikes. Saudi officials defended the huge civilian death toll, insisting the fact that the airstrikes on a known missile depot had caused explosions at all proved the Houthis had been storing their own small arms in the area. Saudi military spokesman went on to say that the strikes were part of a new phase of war against the Houthis, one which he insisted would include protection of civilians. So far, the phase seems not to be off to a great start. Yeah. So there you go, man. The former dictator, Saleh, took American money and weapons and fought the Houthis in the name of fighting Al-Qaeda. And then he also fought so many of his enemies and I guess felt that much less incentive under his American moral hazard to deal with his enemies rather than just dominate them, that when the Arab Spring broke out in Tunisia and then Egypt, it spread immediately to Yemen, and there was a ton of political pressure from all over the different political spectrum as it is in Yemen, and Saleh had to flee. And the Americans helped negotiate his exit. And then they replaced him with this guy, Hadi, and Saleh went and teamed up with his old Houthi enemies and kept brigades of the military that are still loyal to him and started up this war against Hadi, drove him out of the power. And then what does Hadi do? This is the guy of Hillary Clinton's one name on the ballot election back in 2012. Or was it 13? I think 12. He flees to Saudi and then publicly encourages the Saudis to bomb the crap out of his own country, quote-unquote, his own country. The Americans still recognize him as the legitimate president, unlike in Ukraine, where once there was a coup and the president was run out of town, they said, hey, he ran out of town. I guess that means he abdicates. That's the end of that. But in this case, oh, no, he's still the legitimate leader. And so, therefore, they don't need a UN Security Council resolution or anything. They got permission from this guy to bomb his own country. And they're calling it self-defense, even though it's an attack. They're just invoking self-defense. And then the headlines this morning are that the Saudis are going to invade with their military. I think if Eric Margulies was here, he would laugh and tell us that's not going to happen because the Saudis don't really have an army. They have a National Guard, which is basically there to keep the people from overthrowing the government. It's not enough people to march into Yemen and conquer the Houthis. And anyway, as I mentioned, I'm trying to get this guy on the show, Mark Perry, formerly with foreignpolicy.com, now writing for America.aljazeera.com. He's got quotes from U.S. generals saying, this war in Saudi, they call it Saudi intervention, it's America's and Saudi's war against Yemen right now, that this is a bad idea. Again, we're fighting on the side of a local group that we have no legitimate gripe with, who happen to be the greatest enemies of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. America's fighting on the side of Al-Qaeda, again, just like in Syria. It's like we're not doing it in Iraq. We're fighting on the side of Iran and the Quds Force and the Shiite militias like the Baath Brigade and the so-called Iraqi army against the Al-Qaeda types in Iraq. And the Kurds, we're backing the Kurds against them too. But in Syria and Yemen, hey, the more jihadis, the better, I guess. And as I was pointing out on the show yesterday, forget blowback. We got backdraft blowing up right in your face in front of everybody. As soon as we start backing the Saudis' bombing campaign and coordinating it against the Houthis, we saw just over the last couple of days, the Al-Qaeda guys seized an airport, a seaport, and an oil refinery, and a weapons depot, too. And have made major advances. Because America's flying as their air force. America and our imperial proxies, so-called allies. Really? Sounds crazy, but no, really.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I got Dan McAdams on the line. He runs the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And is now a Texan. Welcome back to the show, Dan. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Great to be on your show again.
Good. Very happy to have you here. Let's talk about what's going on in Ukraine. It's so far from here, it seems like it might not matter. And yet, I'm reading a headline here. It says, political murders in Kiev, U.S. troops to Ukraine. I'm not sure which is which, but which is worse. But go ahead and I guess start with the U.S. troops. How many and for what?
Well, it looks like it'll be up to 300, but since it's a battalion, it could be up to 800 troops. This is the 173rd Airborne Brigade, and they've arrived in Ukraine to start training the Ukrainian military. And also, they brought some goodies with them, too, that they're going to leave behind just to help them out. But more seriously, they're training them in infantry tactics. It's very unusual, I think, that a country that's involved in civil conflict would have an outside power coming in to train one side. Isn't that what the U.S. was claiming that Russia was doing and blaming them for it and using it as an excuse to put sanctions on them?
Yeah, well, I mean, and help me understand this, because, okay, if this was happening, I don't know, last summer or something, I'd be completely against it, but I would understand that it made sense in context. But right now, there seems to be the giant obstacle of the fact that we already got a peace deal. Minsk 2's already signed and major powers are behind it. And there has been some fighting, but there's been no official breach of the ceasefire and reinstitution of hostilities. And so who the hell wants to escalate that when we got peace now, Dan?
Well, what I don't know if you saw yesterday, but there were plenty of pictures going out on Twitter and elsewhere about Poroshenko having lunch with the U.S. troops, being photographed with two thumbs up next to the American troops. So it's clear that he takes it as a signal that the U.S. is giving him a green light. And he said as recently, I think as a month ago, that they plan to take back eastern Ukraine. So I think at least in his mind, he's got the U.S. behind him. It's like some scrawny kid on the block who all of a sudden has a big tough guy behind him, starts bullying people around.
Yeah, except in this case, the other guy the big tough guy supposedly bullying is just as tough when it comes down to it and has a lot more reason to fight. I mean, and they've got to know that, right? That, you know, Obama himself has even said, well, I'm not sure how much power and influence he even has on this situation, but he has said, hey, listen, they're not a member of NATO. In like a very kind of frank way that, no, we're not going to war for Ukraine, even if it comes down to it. We're not.
But think about false flags and think about accidents. Think about things of this nature. When you've got 300 or so American troops and you've got a bunch of volunteer battalions, let's put it that way, in Ukraine that have some very unique notions about who were the good guys in history. When you have these types of people that want to suck the U.S. in, don't they have all the incentive in the world to off a couple of American soldiers, make it look like the Russians or make it look like the East Ukrainians or something? It's just talk about just begging for a disaster.
Yeah. Well, and even without that, I mean, they could just, the Kiev government, just like you said, thinking that they have, and maybe correctly thinking that they have America's support, can just attack the East and just, you know, accuse their whatever degree of separatism they actually have of being the pretext. And or, you know, like we saw, I forget if it was in your article. I believe it was in an article that you wrote recently it was at Moon of Alabama blog, where they pointed out how the AP story reported that, yeah, there was some fighting where the guys in Donetsk had fired some shots at the Ukrainian forces. But then the OSCE report, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe there, that the AP report was quoting, when you went and looked at the source, it said that, yeah, right sector attacked them first.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah,
there's not even really necessarily a false flag, but just a provocation that gets ignored. And then call their retaliation the aggressions.
Absolutely. Well, you know, AP is famous for this kind of thing. I mean, they are absolute regime propagandists. I just came back from doing a program with Dr. Paul, and we were talking about Yemen. Different topic, but the same thing. The AP reported that the USS Theodore Roosevelt was steaming toward Yemen to head off all of these Iranian arms shipments that are going to Yemen. But what arms shipments, you know? So the AP does this a lot. And, of course, in this, it was selective reporting when it comes to this. But I think the U.S. probably has some interest in maintaining a kind of strategic ambiguity as to its intentions in Ukraine. But as history shows us, this can also be dangerous. If you remember back in 1956, the U.S. had the same kind of strategic ambiguity where it appeared that they gave a green light to the Hungarians trying to fight the Soviets. When it came down to actually fighting, the Hungarians felt they had the U.S. on their side, but they didn't, and they had no assistance from the U.S. The same thing has happened before in history. So it is a very dangerous thing. And as you point out, Scott, this is not Yemen or Syria that we're kicking around next door. It's a country with, you know, hundreds of strategic nuclear weapons.
Yeah. And tactical ones too. Yeah, another great example of that would be the Great Bear Pigs in the Desert of 1991, when George H.W. Bush urged the Kurds and the Shiites to rise up against Saddam, and then went so far, not just didn't help them, but turned on them and helped Saddam crush their revolution before it got out of hand.
Well, that's a great example. Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, they'll do this kind of thing. They will.
Yeah,
in this case would be at least preferable to going ahead and backing them up, which could mean, as you say, a thermonuclear war. So talk about the political murders in Kiev, because I guess, you know, we've all seen the footage of the fistfights in the parliament. It must be all sides killing each other's political leaders, huh?
Yeah, it's you do see fistfights in parliament. It's quite entertaining. But what is interesting, and this is actually Dr. Paul and I did a little episode of his Liberty Report on this, is that now I think it's up to about 12. And actually, we cited Justin Raimondo's column from earlier this week on the same topic. It's up to about 12 individuals in Ukraine who are affiliated with or members of the now opposition, but who had been affiliated with the Yanukovych government, they have been either they've committed suicide under very strange circumstances. They've been suicided, or in the case this past week where three people were just flat out murdered, including the guy who was the head of the opposition newspaper, the editor-in-chief, although he had resigned a few weeks ago because he said he was having so much political pressure to change his editorial line, was just flat out shot. And to this day, there has not been a single word uttered by the U.S. Government about this. Not that they should get involved, but look at the double standards when it comes to what happened to Boris Nemtsov earlier this year, the Russian minor opposition figure who was gunned down in the streets of Moscow.
Right. And now it really is, a dozen guys have been shot and they're all just calling it Arkansas kind of thing or what?
Well, what Poroshenko, this great, I don't know what to call him, but he said is it's basically a Russian provocation. The Russians have snuck in and they're killing all of their allies in Ukraine just to make Poroshenko look bad.
Yeah.
That's his explanation.
Yeah, I'm not buying that. I mean, I guess anything's possible, but, you know, how many of these leaders of the so-called pro-Russian factions are that expendable to the Russians? You know, it seems like they would need them for later, right?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it could be true. But the fact is, I mean, I think what's, to me at least, what's most interesting in this story is just the blatant double standards and hypocrisy right. when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. I'm less interested in their policy and more in our policy. You know, you have one minor guy killed in Russia. It's terrible. But that very day, you know, John Kerry said, you guys better get to the bottom of this. The chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Ed Royce, essentially blamed Putin for it, you know, right then and there. And here you have 12 people killed and the U.S. hasn't said a word.
Right. All right. Well, yeah. And it's a good comparison because it was just a couple of weeks ago. Everyone can remember the context. It's a, you know, black and white kind of thing. All right. We'll be right back after this with more Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute about the American-backed coup d'etat junta in Ukraine. The violence befalling the opposition parties in their so-called parliament. The ongoing threat of a renewal of the civil war in the east of the country. And by the way, speaking of that, going back to that, I guess, Dan, just how peaceful has been the, I guess, more or less border between the autonomous east and the rest of Ukraine and Ukraine's forces? I know there have been, you know, skirmishes back and forth, but more or less the Minsk II agreement has been holding, correct?
It has not fallen apart. There was an uptick last week. And as you pointed out earlier, the OSCE, which has hardly been pro-East, they even admitted that this uptick was because of some of the Kiev-associated forces. So there had been, there's some tit-for-tat, there's some fighting around the airport in Donetsk and elsewhere. But you're right, it's by and large, it's held for now.
Hmm. And now, we can assume, right, that the special forces are vetting the the regime to make sure everybody is a moderate who's joining up the training of the new National Guard units, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. Just like in Syria. they're all given their copies of the Constitution. And
when I read a headline that says, yeah, we're going to train up their National Guard units, you know me, Dan, I assume the worst. Oh, my God. Are they saying that they're going to train up the Azov Battalion or Azov Battalion, the right sector, the avowed Hitler-loving Nazis? of Ukraine, or are they going to, do they have a PR officer there at all? Anybody who's got an incentive to try to weed those guys out of their new project? Or no, really, it's as cut and dry as, yeah, no, America's going over there and beginning on Hitler's birthday, they're training up a battalion or two of Nazis.
You know, what's kind of sad is that, you know, although I'm appalled by the proclivities of some of these groups, I found that there's absolutely no traction here in the U.S. or in the West at all to point out the obvious that, you know, we've all seen the Hitler tattoos and the SS tattoos and the flags and the salutes. But isn't it weird, Scott, that when you say that here, they look at you as if you're a kook, you know, that you're pointing this out. They'll even say, what are you talking about? The real Nazis are in Russia. What's your problem? You know, and nobody wants to admit what, you know, anyone who wants to look at it would see. These are pretty unsavory types.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I know at antiwar.com, the best one so far that we've run that kind of compiled all the great quotes was by Chris Ernesto, who went and found, and there's plenty of holes in the reporting, right? It's just the narrative hasn't changed, but you can read the Sunday Telegraph or whatever the crap European papers or even the New York Times at times will have an admission here or there. But Chris Ernesto had a great piece where he just compiled all of the best quotes of Western acceptable, quote unquote, acceptable journalists and reports quoting these guys, talking about how much they love Hitler and how they're fighting for the white race and, you know, all the worst kind of things that if they were said by people here in America would cause a panic, you know?
Yeah, and I don't think it's because the Obama administration or the Republicans or anyone here loves Hitler, you know, or loves the Nazis. But, you know, the U.S. has a pattern of this. Look at one of our greatest allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. You know, they don't have a very good record when it comes to human rights either. I think the U.S. finds these are very useful groups to be involved with overseas because they certainly can get things done. You're not going to have the Azov Brigade sitting here reading about human rights and how to make people feel good. You know, if you want to start blowing stuff up and hurting people, that's the kind of people you want on your side.
I guess so. Well, so in a very limited sense, then it makes sense to go ahead and bring them into the military and try to train them and get them, you know, under control of officers instead of just being, you know, neo-Nazi militias out there. Because really, you know, groups like that are mostly good for killing civilians and getting killed and not being very effective in real battle, right?
But that's what you need. You have to demoralize the East. You have to fight psychological warfare against the people in the East. They have to believe that their cause is failed because when it comes to, you know, militarily, they have an advantage because they're fighting for their homeland and what they view as their freedom and liberty. So you have to destroy their morale. I think it's more important than on the battlefield. So when you see these crazed lunatics coming in and, you know, carving people up for fun, that's going to really make people think that maybe this is not a battle worth fighting.
Yeah. But now, on the other hand, I mean, the Minsk agreement for the ceasefire it promises what exactly? They'll rewrite the Constitution in a way concerning those eastern provinces and their degree of autonomy or federal control.
Well, it kind of freezes the conflict in a way. I mean, it's not anything. I think to the extent that it stops the active fighting, it's something that's good because innocent people were getting killed. But in terms of a long-term solution, it really isn't because to the people in the East, if you can imagine, we'd feel the same way. They never want to be part of Minsk again. These are the guys that took up arms against them. They don't feel they're legitimate. They've bombed their houses. So they're never going to, pardon me, want to join again. It's going to be sort of a frozen conflict on the lines of Serbia and Kosovo, and that's probably the best case scenario, unless there's some way to have a real autonomy. And certainly the Kiev side does not see the Minsk agreements as granting any kind of real autonomy or even independence. So it's put on hold, I think, the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, so the thing is about a conflict this big or with implications this big is it seems like there must be some kind of very deliberate plan behind it. But the best I can see is really the most retail level politics that the Republicans are saying, oh, yeah, be tough on Russia, that kind of thing. This is a battle politically Obama doesn't want to fight. I mean, it is his government that got us into it. I'm not trying to acquit the man of the thing. But I'm mm-hmm. just saying, I guess, Dan, use my best imagination. I don't see much sense behind picking this level of a fight with Russia, when they see that this is the kind of consequence they get, it seems like they, with Minsk too, they were being offered a very easy out. And now here they are continuing to escalate the thing by sending in trainers and more equipment and more money when their bluff had been called, right?
Yeah, but the thing in Washington among the foreign policy community is that they really are in an echo chamber, whether you're at Brookings or Heritage, wherever you go for the so-called experts, they're all involved in the revolving door between government and the so-called think tank private sector, and they all listen to each other. If someone like you or I went over there, Scott, and sat down at one of these lunches and talked the way we're talking now, they'd look at us as if we were blue, you know, with feet growing out of our head or something. You know, it really is an echo chamber. So I think they do believe their own propaganda. And I think that is that, you know, we've seen throughout history, that's a very, very dangerous thing to do.
Yep. Well, yeah, 100 years ago, had World War I based on this kind of jackassery, basically. widespread and all around. Could happen again. Yeah, thanks for doing your part, Dan. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. Take care, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Daniel McAdams. He's at the Ron Paul Institute, ronpaulinstitute.org. We'll be right back.
Hey, y'all. Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. That was Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute. Now, was it the spotlight today? I forget. What did I do with this thing? Yeah, I made it the spotlight today. Look at antiwar.com. It's Gareth Porter's piece at Truth Out. The spotlight today is Gareth Porter's piece at Truth Out. The possible military dimensions bomb that could blow up the Iran deal. Get it? It's a metaphor. You got the Iran deal and there's a bomb that could blow it up. And the bomb that could blow it up is this boring, ridiculous thing called possible military dimensions. The PMD. Well, what about the PMD, everybody? Well, the possible military dimensions are all a bunch of crap. You got the telexes. You got the smoking laptop. I guess the telexes don't count, but anyway, include them. You got the telexes. You got the smoking laptop. And then you got a few more documents that came about 4 or 5 years later after the smoking laptop. All of it's a bunch of crap. The telexes... those were American intercepts of a bunch of orders from the Iranian university that was not acting as a subsidiary of the military at the time to obtain a bunch of dual-use items that went toward their civilian use. And when the IAEA investigated, they said, yep, here's the stuff we bought, here's the receipt, and here it is sitting on the shelf doing what we said it was for, which had nothing to do with nuclear or anything. Totally debunked. And then you had the smoking laptop, which, as Gareth explains in here, is admittedly from, you know, it's not even a secret or an accusation or anything. It's admittedly on by the Americans, by the IAEA and the experts. The origin of the laptop is the Mujahideen e-Kalk, the communist terrorist cult that, again, everyone agrees and is not in dispute, are simply, at this point, the sock puppets of Israeli intelligence. And when you examine the all the accusations, you know, the so-called facts in those documents and the accusations that come from them, it all falls apart. It's all a bunch of crap. You know, they tried to say that the military was in charge of the mine and they had forged all these documents trying to make it look like the military was in charge of the mine. But it wasn't true. It was debunked. And then there was the accusation that they had a bench-level experiment planned to use lasers to purify uranium to tetrafluoride, so-called green salt. But why would they bother doing that when they have a facility to make uranium hexafluoride gas, which is what they need to introduce it into their centrifuges to spin it and enrich it? So made no sense anyway, and it was just a bench-level experiment anyway. Nothing scandalous there. And then they had a design for a delivery vehicle to go on the top of a missile that was, at the time that the documents were being forged, was secretly going obsolete and was being replaced by newer, better missile. And so the foragers, oops, would have had us believe that the Iranian nuclear weapons program was designing a warhead and a delivery vehicle for a missile that they were retiring and replacing. Debunked again. And then what else is in there? A couple other things in there. Plenty of forgeries, plenty of missing official stamps. And then the stuff that came in 2009 or so, well, that's funny. The mathematics on these graphs are completely wrong. And this work order between Iranians and Russians, why is it in English? And they had a chart. This is where Yosef Butt comes in, the nuclear physicist. He's debunking the charts that supposedly graph the modeling of a nuclear explosion. None of these numbers are right. None of these numbers have any relation to reality. What are you even talking about? This is obviously fake. And then the explosive bridge wires are obviously improvably for mining work, so you can get clear before setting off explosives. The Parchin accusations that the Iranians had a secret bomb testing chamber at their Parchin facility. The IAEA inspected it twice, found nothing like that. And the explosives chamber that they're accused of having is no good for what they are accused of using it for, testing explosives and implosion systems for a nuclear weapon. A bunch of nonsense. Bunch of accusations based on pink tarps. That's not a pink tarp. That's Corning insulation, dude. Yeah, those satellite photos, they'll get your lying eyes, man, if you don't squint tight. Look, everybody, a pink tarp, cried David Albright at ISIS. That must mean that they're hiding nuclear work, huh? And the whole story was that this guy, Danilenko, was a Soviet nuclear weapons scientist who helped the Iranians come up with all of this. And yet this whole thing was completely debunked, including by Robert Kelly, formerly of the IAEA, who pointed out that they were supposed to design and build this thing in 1 year. According to the story, the way it works out, it couldn't possibly be. And then Gareth showed that Danilenko was no nuclear scientist whatsoever. Yeah, he had worked at the same academy in the Soviet Union, but his specialty was creating nanodiamonds for industry. And that doesn't have anything to do with expertise in setting off a nuclear fission chain reaction. And in other words, is all a bunch of hype. You think where there's smoke, there's fire, but no, it's steam. It's just hot air, no fire. Just a bunch of crap. But an endless list of crap. And so now we come to the dilemma, as Gareth and I were discussing on the show last, Friday or something like that. We have a real problem. Where, and as he says in his great article here at Truthout, Obama has continue to say, yeah, they have to fess up to the PMD and all this kind of crap. Well, so it is a bunch of crap. But what are they going to do? They're going to stick by, when did you stop beating your wife? And make them confess to halting a false accusation? Tricky. Or, since it's a bunch of crap, are they going to say, ah, forget it, that PMD is a bunch of crap, and we're not going to worry about that. Robert Kelly has debunked most of this stuff, and Gareth Porter the rest, and then we're good. That would be the honest way out. No, that would be a dishonest way out, but it would be a better way out than pretending that a bunch of debunked nonsense remains a group of possible military dimensions, a very serious concerns that the Iranians must resolve. They could kill this deal with a bunch of nonsense. Based on a bunch of lies from the Mujahideen e-call communist terrorist cult that used to work for the Ayatollah Khomeini and then work for Saddam Hussein and then work for Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and then, well, and around the same time, has worked for the Israeli Mossad. Funneling nonsense. And just look up MEK and state.gov or whatever it is, and you can read where the State Department themselves even debunk the MEK's accusations routinely. Oh, look, everybody, there's this facility outside of Tehran. Yeah, but there's some guy taking selfies from the facility an hour later going, this is nothing but a whatever textile factory or whatever it is. Liars. Oh, look, everybody, there are these tunnels outside of Tehran. Yeah, the American CIA has known about those tunnels for 10 years, and there ain't nothing nuclear about them. And oh, look, they have a plan to cut grooves in a uranium sphere and then just set off some debt cord, and then that'll cause a fission bomb. What? Those are in the Sunday Times. Plenty of lies in the Sunday Times. But just Google up MEK and false accusations about Iran's nuclear program. You'll find plenty. And these are the kinds of lies that could scotch the deal. Oh, is that racist? Are you not allowed to say scotch anymore?
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys, welcome back. So, I was saying earlier on the show, man, this could be a whole Gulf of Tonkin thing right here with Yemen. And I thought, I don't know, man. That probably won't happen right now, right? I don't know. Maybe. And then I see Patrick Lange, the former DIA and CIA guy, saying, is this another Gulf of Tonkin coming? Oh, man. Stop ratifying my beliefs. I don't like that. I would prefer if, you know, serious people experienced in the national security state would think that my point of view is a little out of line, you know? Nah, don't worry. That won't happen. That's what I want to hear. Anyway, I don't know. So listen, I got to talk about Palestine and America as occupied territory, too. First of all, I suck about covering Palestine. I need to do a lot better on the show. And the reason why is because I think that most Americans just absolutely have no idea about the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. They just don't know the story. And TV, I think most importantly, TV never shows the American TV audience a map of Israel and Palestine and says, all right, everybody, look, so this part is the occupied territory. This is the part where it's the Palestinians who live there, but it's the Israelis who rule it with their military. Oh, yeah, also there are colonists who are slowly and steadily stealing their land and separating them from their olive trees and their families, torturing their children. And I think that if they ever did that, then opinions on the matter might change. Because the American government, you and I could argue, and I might be on a few different sides of this argument, you and I could argue about how responsible we are for what our government does. But there's just no question that our government is responsible for what the Israeli government does to a great degree. And so to whatever degree you think that, you know, you got responsibility for the behavior of your government in this democracy, in this limited constitutional republic, yeah, maybe exercise your voice a little bit. Teach other people the truth about it. Because we gave $3 billion, and really more than that, including all the loans and guarantees and subsidies and hardware to the Israelis every year. And that includes all our best jets, which that could be sabotage. Be careful, guys. All of our best radars and equipment and whatever. And we give them the money to subsidize their military way of life and still have their robust social programs. Would be a nice way of putting it for Republicans, I guess. Their communist economy. Oh, it's not, it's more fascist now, but it's pretty damn regulatory. But anyway, the occupation in the West Bank, it couldn't go on without American military and other subsidy and without our coverage for them in the UN Security Council and in the rest of global politics. And I guess, I don't know, maybe it's easy, I guess I have to admit, it's easy and convenient, it works for Israelis and Americans just the same, to say, oh yeah, the whole world's against us. That just proves what a dangerous and horrible world we live in, how horrible everybody else in the world is. But you know, it's possible that maybe you did something that you're not thinking of that they're mad at. That's a real thing. In the case of Israel, they've occupied the Gaza Strip and the West Bank of the Jordan River, and including East Jerusalem, and colonized them and brutalized the people there for longer than the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe, for 48 years. Generations have gone by, well, 2.5, 3 generations have gone by, living completely under Israeli foreign military martial law. Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, those are basically prison trustees. They're not even the guards. They work for the Israelis, keeping the internal population down and getting a little bit more of the spoils for themselves. They're politicians. But the Palestinians have virtually no rights whatsoever. And you know, back in 2005, when Ariel Sharon decided he was going to pull the last of the Israeli Jewish settlers out of the Gaza Strip, which he pretended was some kind of peace effort, just moved them to the West Bank. Eric Garris at antiwar.com said, oh no, this is terrible, because in effect, not that they have the right to be settlers colonizing the place or anything, but it's going to be terrible because it means that, you know, basically these Israeli Jewish settlers were voluntary. Not that they meant to be necessarily, although in some cases maybe they did, but they were voluntary, quote-unquote, human shields. Unlike the subhuman Palestinian Arabs, I guess. And so the worst that the Israeli state had to offer the people of Gaza was restrained, because there were Jewish Israeli settlers that lived in Gaza too. Although many fewer than in the West Bank. But once they pulled the settlers out of Gaza, they simply turned it into a prison. The whole thing is like Escape from New York, Prison by the Sea. That's how Eric predicted it back in 2005 when Sharon first started talking about it. This is what he explained to me was going to happen. It'll just be a big concentration camp. And that's exactly what it is. And you know, it's funny. They did such a good job of demonizing Julian Assange. Was it because of his long white hair that just made him seem like such a James Bond villain? Is that what it was? They did such a good job of demonizing him that they made the term WikiLeaks sound somewhat kind of tainted, even though it's kind of ridiculous. And they're just a pile of government documents. I mean, when people say the WikiLeaks, typically they mean the Chelsea Manning Hall, the State Department cables, and the Iraq and Afghan war logs, and the Guantanamo files, right? And so when people say, oh, it's in the WikiLeaks, what they're saying is it's in State Department communications to each other, the different levels of our foreign policy departments talking to each other in secret. This is what they say. That's what WikiLeaks is short for. Candid admissions of truth. And sometimes false accusations, too. But what they're mostly good for is canned admissions of truth from American government employees talking to each other and saying things like, even quoting Israeli officials, saying that the policy for Gaza is to keep the people hungry, but not starving. To keep them hungry. That's the deliberate policy. A population where the majority of them are minors. A majority of them are under 18. They're not minors at all. They're the majority. And none of them, by definition, none of them could have possibly been guilty of voting for Hamas back in the American-held election in 2006. Or the Elliott Abrams attempted coup against Hamas after they won that just led to them solidifying their power in Gaza. They're kids. They're kids. Keep them hungry, but not starving. Dove Weissglass, who was Ehud Olmert's right-hand man at the time, I forget his exact position, but he was a very high-level minister in the government, intelligence minister or something. And Dove Weissglass said, yes, we just want to keep them on a diet. We don't want to starve them to death. We just want to put them all on a diet. This is how he talks about human beings locked in a concentration camp. And when I mean locked in a concentration camp, I mean locked in a concentration camp. They're not allowed to leave. They're not allowed to travel to Egypt. They're not allowed to travel to Israel. They're not allowed to travel to Syria. They're not allowed to travel to Turkey. They're not allowed to travel to Italy. Or Greece. Or America. They even had a thing where this one actually made the news, like it mattered for a minute, that you had kids in Palestine in the Gaza Strip who had qualified for a Fulbright scholarship to come to America to go to school, and the Israelis wouldn't let them leave. You know, you turn on Fox News, you would think that Palestine is the superpower next door, threatening poor little Israel. Just because they have to lie to you, because if they tell you the truth about who's who and who's the underdog, you might pick sides, the people being treated unfairly. People who deserve a little bit of justice might take a little bit higher priority. And just think of it the other way around for a minute. What if in these wars all the Palestinian Arabs had been successful since the foundation of Israel? And they had... Oh, man. I didn't hear the music playing. What if they had the Israeli Jews penned in the Gaza concentration camp and in occupied, walled-in territory under martial law in the West Bank? Just imagine that for one moment. The question answers itself, right? America and the entire Western world would go to war against those Arabs until it was the other way around. Which is, I guess, in effect, what they did do. Anyway, bye.